Hello and welcome to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco. In this programme, we're focusing on ending tenancies well. The legal and regulatory aspects like deposits, inventories and handing over the keys. But also, the end of a tenancy is the end of a relationship. And how can landlords manage this as harmoniously and constructively as possible? And what pitfalls should tenants be mindful of? Well, I'm joined in the studio by Susie Hirschman, Head of Disputes Resolution at My Deposits, Lisa Williamson, Chief Operations Officer from No Letting Go, and Al McLenahan, Director of Justice for Tenants. Well, let me start off with you, Lisa. Can you tell us a bit about the sort of bare essentials of an effective inventory? Because that certainly does come into play at the end of a tenancy, doesn't it?
It certainly does. And from our experience, actually, how the tenancy ends is often determined at the start, because if you have a good watertight inventory in place, there's far less chance for a dispute to arise at the end. And so in our opinion, the bare essentials for an inventory are for it to have a good, easy format to follow, concise information, good, clear photographs, and really important to not only list the contents and the fixtures of the property, but also the cleanliness and the condition throughout.
Now, sometimes people tell me that videos are useful to have rather than photos. So I'm never quite clear which is best out of those. And then also there's the issue about whether stuff should be date stamped. What advice can you offer us on that?
We don't tend to rely on videos too much because they are quite hard to play back if there's a dispute at the end to send an adjudicator to a particular part of a video. And also, unless the lighting is really good, it's often difficult to tell what an item looks like at the end compared to at the start. But with regards to photographs being date stamped, if they're embedded in the inventory, then there's no real requirement for those photographs to be date stamped because the inventory itself has a date on it and it's normally signed and dated by the tenants. But if a landlord is considering not having an inventory, which we wouldn't advocate, and just a set of photographs, then it's really important that they are date stamped and acknowledged and signed by the tenant.
And what about the sort of language that we should be using in inventories, Lisa? I tend to do my own inventories, I must admit, because I like to kind of really assess every little bit of the property, and I find kind of doing it myself makes me feel better. I don't know why, but I tend to use phrases like nearly new, you know, or immaculate if it's brand new. Or should I be being a bit more technical?
We can always tell at No Letting Go when we're working from a landlord's inventory, because it will always say immaculate, nothing wrong with it, brand spanking new. And that can be looked at as being a little bit biased. With our inventories, we have a glossary of terms so that if we say that something is in fair condition, there's an explanation as to what fair condition is. And similarly, if we say that something is professionally clean, we're talking about five-star hotel, the Ritz clean, where you can see your face reflection in the taps in the bathroom and so on. So we'll have definitions for the level of cleanliness, so professionally clean all the way down to not clean at all, which actually means really dirty. But we don't say really dirty in our inventories. But yeah, it's really important to have a glossary of terms so that whoever is doing the adjudication at the end can tell what your benchmark was.
Oh, so you're really kind of dotting the I's and crossing the T's.
Absolutely,
and it's pretty
yes.
mathematical in many ways, isn't it?
Yes. It is, yes.
Let me come to you, Al. What are the main reasons why tenancies can end unhappily for tenants?
The main reason that we found really is disputes over deductions to the deposit. And just to echo what Lisa is saying, a large part of that does come down to how well laid out the process is at the end, tenants understanding what's going on with their deposit. And it's more common that there is a dispute when the landlord has done their own inventory. Much more so. It just tends to lack the same kind of structure, the same clarity. It doesn't have a photo for each item, whereas when it's done by a professional agency such as Lisa's, it's there's less room for interpretation, and that tends to reduce a lot of the disputes.
Now, if you do have a dispute around a deposit, you can use the resolution service that the deposit protection schemes have, can't you? Or you can go to the county court. Do tenants tend to have a preference?
With tenants, it tends to be what they know to be an option. By and large, we always recommend to tenants to use the dispute resolution service. And I think it's probably better for landlords And tenants, the reason why, part of the reason why the dispute schemes were brought in, I assume, is because the county courts are getting very full of these kind of claims. They're very common. A dispute scheme using their resolution service. First of all, the act of compiling the evidence often makes people a little bit more reasonable on both sides, so quite often it's resolved before the actual adjudication, just from the process of preparing for it. And the adjudicators have special training at schemes like My Deposits. It's quicker, it's cheaper, and you have someone who is specially trained to deal with it, which not all judges are.
Now, talking of someone who's specially trained to deal with it, I've got Susie Hirschman here, who is Head of Disputes Resolution at My Deposits. Susie, tell us a bit about the typical sources of disputes. I bet cleaning comes high on the list, doesn't it?
Cleaning is always top of the list. It doesn't matter which year you try and analyse things to see if they've changed, but they don't. I think Lisa made a really good point about inventories not always being very clear on the definition between condition and cleaning. They are two very separate things, and it's really the really simple way of thinking about it from a tenant or a landlord perspective is to think that fair wear and tear, which is a whole different aspect that we can talk about maybe later, will apply to anything with a condition. But cleaning is just that. So if it was cleaned to a professional standard at the beginning and the tenancy is 14 years long, it will still need to be cleaned to a professional standard when they leave. So the cleaning standard should never change, but everything else around that will.
So let's think about, for example, a wooden floor. What would be the difference between a bit of wear and tear on that and it not being properly mopped or maybe you're supposed to use a special machine or something to clean it?
Okay, so there's a couple of points that come out of that question. The first thing is if it's a bit of speciality equipment that's being given. So let's not just think about wooden floors. We might think about marble worktops. We might think about other specific materials used in the property. A landlord always has to be very careful to give out the proper directions for maintaining that equipment, just not to just rely on the tenant knowing what to do. So that's the first thing. The second thing is when it comes to wooden floors, a landlord has to be very careful how prescriptive they are to make sure the tenant can live in that property as his home. So you can't necessarily stop a tenant from wearing high heels in the property. If it's a not an expensive floor, then damage can happen. It becomes a very grey area over whose responsibility something like that would be. So
that's very interesting because I've had floor damage from high heels, actually.
Okay.
Yes, and, there were basically little marks all over my beautiful pine wooden floors.
Yes.
And in fact, I used to say to tenants at the beginning that they asked them not to wear high heels, but that's not acceptable.
Well, it's not. I mean, if a tenant will comply and they're quite happy with that, then and you've made it very clear to them, then obviously there is a point for discussion at the end. But one needs to be very careful about how prescriptive you are directing the tenant on how to live in that property.
And I remember Susie once going on, I think it was an NLA workshop on, disputes. And one of the scenarios where was this sort of classic iron burn on the carpet, which, was just damaged the kind of quarter of the carpet. But the landlord, of course, said that the whole carpet needed to be changed and was then very disappointed as to how much money they got back at the end. Okay. What happens in that sort of scenario?
Again, from an adjudication perspective and even in the courts, they will look at the proportion of carpet that is damaged and to what extent it's been damaged and what would be the most reasonable way of compensating the landlord. So then you talk about fair wear and tear as well. So how old was it? What was the condition at the start? Is there just an iron burn or was it already stained and damaged beforehand? That might go to how much where there is left in that carpet. So it all becomes part of assessing the compensation. It's not to say the landlord won't have compensation, but the chances of him being given the full replacement cost are pretty slim because the tenant will have had wear for the time he's been in the property. So it's really important for landlords to think about, even if the tenant hadn't caused the damage, there would be wear and tear. And I have to consider that before I make a deduction.
Yes, I mean, I always assume that something has a lifespan of, say, 7 years. Say if it's a carpet, maybe 7 years. Might be a bit too long, I don't know, maybe 5 years. And if the tenant's been there for 3 years, then, it's had 3 years of wear and tear and only then has 2 years of life left. So there's only so much compensation you could get if the carpet were damaged beyond wear and tear.
That's exactly how it works.
Right.
We take a general approach of 5 years for something like a carpet or decor. Now, that's not set in stone. That will then depend on the quality of the evidence that's supplied with that case as to whether that increases or decreases. And I don't know how many of your listeners are students, for example, but, 5 years would probably be a tall ask for a lifespan of something in a student property.
Yes.
Maybe 3 years would be more appropriate because of the quality of the fittings and things that a landlord will do in a student property. It's all about managing everyone's expectation, not just the landlord, not just the tenant, but actually saying, well, hold on a minute to the landlord. Who are your tenants? What should you expect from them? Are you allowing a pet in the property? You expect a little bit more wear and tear, but you're going to have great tenants who love the property, are very happy you're a landlord that's let them have the pet in there, and they pay their rent on time every month.
And I always say to landlords who get a bit cross about tenants wearing things out a bit quicker than they'd like, I've had an oven for 10 years, but I wouldn't expect my tenant's oven to last 10 years because if something's not your own, maybe you don't put as much TLC into taking care of it. And, there will be numerous users over the years. So people need to take a different perspective, don't they?
I think that's very true.
Okay, well, Lisa, coming back to you, I was going to ask you, what does an inventory clerk bring to the table that a landlord can't do his or herself? I've already had a bit of a ticking off on that, haven't I? But it's really much more involved than people think, isn't it?
It certainly is. And No Letting Go is a franchise operation. We have 65 offices now throughout the UK, and I've had the pleasure of training all of them. And it can take anything up to 3 months, actually, to train an inventory clerk in all aspects of their work, because they're not only compiling the inventory, but they need to learn the rules in carrying out property visits, because obviously they have to respect the fact that at the time of an interim property visit, or some people refer to them as inspections, it's the tenant's home, and they have the right to live a certain lifestyle. And if they decide that they want to scatter their clothes all over the place, then we have to respect that that's their decision. And then also you have the checkout, and obviously that's a huge amount for an independent inventory clerk to take on board to decide. We often make the decision whether any damage is consistent with fair wear and tear, as Susie said, depending on the length of the tenancy and what the quality was of the original item, or whether it's an issue which is a landlord's maintenance issue. Things such as loose toilet seats are usually in line with a landlord's maintenance issue. So huge responsibility on our shoulders. But of course, a clerk will have the independence and they won't be biased. And so if there is a dispute, as Al said, that normally the dispute services will prefer an independent inventory management service because they know it is going to be largely unbiased.
Yes, that's a crucial point, isn't it? That independence. Now, we know that tenancy fees are going to be banned from the 1st of June. And so landlords will need to pay for entry and exit inventory checks. In the past, some landlords have paid for the entry and expected the tenant to pay for the exit and so on. Do you think this is likely to affect your business, Lisa?
We don't think so, actually. And having spoken to the majority of our clients, obviously they're looking at ways of recouping those costs. But the landlord usually always paid for the inventory, and they would either pay for the checkout or the check-in. So whichever one they didn't pay for is the one that the tenant would pay for. So it's only one cost to us that they have got to replace. And most of them see the value in having that carried out by an independent person. So whether they're going to absorb that cost or whether they'll look to make any increase in rents, Time will tell, but we're certainly not seeing or hearing from our clients that they are going to stop any of those processes, because they realise that if they're going to make a claim on the deposit, they need to have their house in order.
Would you recommend pre-checkout meetings, Lisa, with tenants? Something I've started doing where, say, a month before the tenant's due to move out, I meet them in the property and I walk round and suggest to them things that might need to be done, you know, in order to bring the property up to the standard that's required for the checkout.
Yes, I think that's a great idea. The problem is who's going to pay for it? Because the landlord, certainly after the tenant fee ban is introduced, will say most likely that they don't want to pay for it. And it's educating the tenants. Is there a value in them actually paying for that type of service? But there is huge value in it, because there's things often that they don't realise are part of their obligations in the tenancy agreement. I've used to do a lot of checkouts myself, and tenants would say at a pre-checkout meeting, oh, I didn't realise I had to do the garden, I wasn't supplied with a lawnmower. And if the tenancy agreement says that the tenant's responsible for doing the garden, then it doesn't mean that they have to be provided with the tools to do so. So I think it is a really valuable experience for the tenants, and it can often save them money further down the line.
Yes, I mean, Al, I'm all for this sort of educational approach with tenants, that you, you know, try to work with them in a way that helps them understand the process and helps them get the best out of the ending, I guess, if you like. I mean, does that chime with you? Do you think tenants appreciate that kind of approach?
I think they do. I think it also depends on who is doing it. If it's a landlord doing it, not everyone's going to be able to maintain a relationship while having a disagreement like you might be able to with your tenants. Some landlords, some people are not as good with conflict, and they get a bit emotional about it, particularly if it's a property they used to live with. So sometimes I think for some people it might just escalate the matter if they were to do it themselves as a landlord. But as a concept, I think it does make a lot of sense, because I think the education gap isn't really generally considered. A lot of times people aren't aware where the liability lies, and being made aware of it earlier makes it possible for tenants to resolve things that they didn't know that were their responsibility, often cheaper and at their own expense, than if it were deducted afterwards.
Yeah, and I mean, thinking about how to avoid disputes, I'm conscious, I meet a lot of landlords at landlord meetings, and some of them seem to get very litigious about the ending and, you know, start slapping down Section 21 notices and so on. And it seems to me it's often more effective to talk to the tenant if you've got having difficulties at the end.
Yeah, I think so. You can interpret it one of two ways. I think if you're a landlord who thought you had tenants who were planning on moving out and there wasn't any issue there, and then they didn't, and you had to start the process of a Section 21 prior to possession proceedings, I think then you will, going forward, be more inclined to think, I'll play it safe, and when I give notice, I will do a Section 21 notice. So you're well within your rights to do that. I suppose the flip side of that is that sometimes that negatively affects the relationship, and oftentimes, I think, when tenants are served Section 21 notices, they can be quite angry because it's their home, and they often feel like they haven't done anything wrong, they've paid the rent. And sometimes that can lead to people maybe not taking care of the property, maybe not paying the final month's rent or something like that. So it's a risk-reward kind of situation. I don't think it's clear whether you should or you shouldn't. I think if you are going to serve a Section 21, make sure you do it correctly and in accordance with guidance.
Yes, and I mean, I often think that as landlords, we need to respect the fact that Section 21 is a privilege, really, being able to take possession of your property without giving a reason, and it should be used with care. If I ever need tenants to move out, I often try and give them 6 months' notice, you know, and then assist in any way that I can with the move. Do you think it's ever possible, though, Al, to end a tenancy well, where the tenant's in arrears? Because that can be very tricky, can't it? And lots of emotions can start to come into play.
Yeah, sometimes. It really depends on the people involved. A lot of the calls that we get at Justice for Tenants are for people who are in arrears and have maintained some kind of relationship with the landlord, keeping them up to speed, showing sort of their efforts to resolve things, particularly if they're entitled to some form of universal credit or housing benefit. Payments, because often they get stopped and the tenant doesn't know why. The landlord tries to get the tenant to sort it out and they try. And it can all be resolved, but if it's not managed well, then sometimes it doesn't get resolved and they are asked to leave. It really does depend. If the tenant is explaining their situation, the landlord is sympathetic, it can be resolved. I think particularly when the arrears aren't that high, if there's an agreement to deduct some of it from a deposit, then it can work fairly well. Once the arrears get to a relatively high amount, though, I haven't really seen any circumstances where it doesn't end with hurt feelings.
Yes, yeah, I've been there myself, and it's hard not to get really cross, you know, the injustice of it all as a landlord. But of course, as you remind us, there are many reasons why tenants might find themselves in that situation when it's not entirely their fault. Susie, how about you? I mean, how can landlords deduct from the deposit and end the relationship well? Is it possible?
Well, I think it's possible when you look at the statistics for the number of disputes that come our way, which is less than 3%, something like 2.9, 2.5% of all protections are resolved. Now, how they're resolved and how acrimonious they have been, we don't have that data and we will never know. But I think bearing in mind the number of disputes that we deal with, which is still 7,000 plus a year, you know, we still would like to see more resolved. But I think in terms of ending a tenancy well, it is all about everything we've talked about today. It's about having all the evidence, about making sure the quality of the evidence is good. Keeping records of phone calls, for example, is a really small thing, but follow it up with a one-line email. Just to follow up what we just chatted about, whether it's a text or an email or something that you will then keep. And you have it as a negotiation tool, because I like to talk about, I rather go out, when I go out and I educate people, I talk about negotiation. I don't talk about adjudication, because I like to think that most of the things I'm talking about can be resolved before adjudication. So negotiation is key, and without good evidence, and without the ability to speak face-to-face, which is the best way of negotiating, which there are many agents that can't do that, which is why they always rely on an independent inventory, which is great. That's going to get their backs on behalf of their landlords. But if a landlord does his own inventory, we don't have a problem with that, as long as the tenant signed it and had the opportunity to make comment on it. But you've heard both sides of the story, where it's, you know, most disputes will happen on the back of landlords doing them themselves because the quality is not the same. So for us as adjudicators, it doesn't matter. But you can see which side of the coin the landlords lean towards. Mm. So and that helps. But in terms of ending tenancies well, negotiation is definitely key. I think end of tenancy guidance is key. We have many situations where landlords and agents will provide tenants with information a month before. So they might not necessarily go and visit the property. They don't have the time. They might not be living in the country, wherever they are, whatever the situation. There are lots of ways of managing the end of the tenancy that can have a good, that will end up in a good scenario.
Yes, I mean, I'd always recommend a checkout letter. I always do a checkout letter that, you know, clarifies the exact time that I'm having keys handed over to me. I list some of the things that can tend to go wrong around cleaning and so on, and recommend getting professional cleaners because, you know, that's often the best way and so on.
Sorry, I'm working on some guides at the moment for everybody, agents, landlords and tenants, on things to do at the beginning, do's and don'ts, if you like, at the beginning of the tenancy, do's and don'ts at the end of the tenancy, and things for tenants to consider. So I'm looking at bite-sized guides that anybody can use out there, because I think there are little gaps in people's knowledge, whoever they are, as to how to end well.
One of the things is that we're meant to return the deposit within 10 days, of course, of the end date of the tenancy. And I like the fact that with the My Deposits insurance-based scheme, as the landlord, I can return the deposit when I'm ready. And often I will do that within a day, you know, if I'm sure that everything's fine. And it seems to me that that's a good kind of customer service thing to be able to
do.
As well.
It is. It really is.
And do you think we're likely to see more of these new no-deposit insurance schemes?
Well, it's certainly it's a growing industry. How successful it will be long term, I think, remains to be seen. There was actually an article last weekend about one particular scheme saying that their deposit ratio was exactly the same as the deposit scheme's ratio. So there's actually no difference between that product and the traditional deposit protection. But I think the government are sitting back and watching and waiting. As we know, there's lots of regulation coming, lots of consultation going on. And I think they're sort of factoring how this product works in the market. So I'm not in a position to comment on the longevity of it or whether it will take over the world. But I think it's here to stay for the moment, and time will tell.
And there's a concern, of course, that if the tenant isn't handing over a substantial sum of money, that, you know, perhaps they won't care as much about issues of making damage, etc. I think I've heard some landlords say that, and I've heard tenants' organisations argue that it's not regulated properly at the moment and they have some concerns about it. So,
well, I would welcome Al's thoughts on it, but I certainly know that the products out there vary. So it's not the same. It's not the same as deposit protection, where you have, it's a product and it's the same for all three schemes. All of these zero deposits are different products in themselves.
Yes, a quick thought, Al, from you on these insurance schemes, where instead of taking a deposit from the tenant, the tenant pays a sum for insurance.
Yes, and I think it actually isn't a bad idea of the product, because for a lot of tenants, the realistic alternative is to pay a similar amount of money for a loan to cover the shortfall before one deposit is returned and the other is paid. I think it's in the Wild West stage at the moment, where pretty much anyone can do anything, and there will be a lot of providers who will probably be found to not pay out and will give it a bit of a bad reputation. And as is the case with most kind of new industries that pop up and disrupt the market, what will then happen is either it will be legislated out of existence, or it will be legislated with a tighter remit when people have an idea of what's going on. And I hope it's the second, because I think it is a useful option. I have concerns about agencies potentially profiting from it if they have some financial benefit or referral arrangement. So I would hope that it would continue, but there would be legislation that prevents profiteering from it and ensures that actually it's providing the service that people are thinking, without reading 20 pages of terms and conditions to landlords and to tenants.
Okay, well, you're listening to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco, and my guests are Susie Hirschman, Head of Disputes Resolution at My Deposits, Lisa Williamson, Chief Operations Officer from No Letting Go, and Al McLennan, Director of Justice for Tenants. Now, Lisa, you alluded earlier to situations where tenants don't do much cleaning and perhaps their clothes are all over the bedroom floor, etc., etc. What do you do about those situations, you know, when the place is a complete tip and you want to do viewings? You know, this is really a kind of management question, I guess, and it's certainly come up several times for me.
Yes, it is a difficult one, because most tenancy agreements do allow for the agent or the landlord to show the property during the last month of the tenancy. And obviously they're taking prospective new tenants around, and the place is a tip. It's not showing it in its best light. However, you know, the Housing Act says that the tenants have the right to a degree, live how they like, as long as it's not causing a detrimental effect on the landlord's property. And so I think as a landlord or an agent, you have to take a view. If you've done your regular inspections and you know that these particular tenants are very messy, it may well be that you take the decision that you'll wait until they've moved out. You've had the opportunity to tidy up the place, redecorate if necessary, and then show the property in its best light. I think it very much depends on the area and the local market. You know, central place, central city locations, properties tend to let very quickly. Other areas, they don't let so quickly. So, of course, then the landlord risks having a void period if they wait until the tenants move out.
I think one of the issues with untidiness and uncleanliness is managing the landlord managing their own emotions, because sometimes it can feel like you know, the property just isn't being looked after. But I often think, as if that tenant stays 2, 3, 4 years, the property will probably be ready for redecoration anyway. So, and it never ceases to amaze me how quickly properties come up to almost sort of brand spanking new again, really, with a good lick of paint and a professional clean. So,
yes, absolutely. Something that can look quite shocking at the time of the checkout can be resolved fairly quickly. But as Susie mentioned earlier, however old the property is, it should still be left in the same state of cleanliness as it was found at the start. And it can be difficult to get the tenants' understanding as to what clean means. Landlords, tenants, agents often have very different views of what the level of cleanliness is, which is why, as I go back to what I said right at the very start, it's so important to have the glossary of terms of cleanliness so that everybody knows what the exact condition of cleanliness was at the start.
Susie, I always worry about the kind of small amounts. You know, maybe I'm wanting to deduct a bit for cleaning, or there's some mould in the bathroom that really could have been cleaned. And, you know, I had supplied some HG mould cleaner, or, you know, other mould cleaners are available. and then I think, well, an otherwise harmonious relationship can be soured, you know, by perhaps the tenant refusing to pay that £100 towards cleaning. And I've seen landlords go to, or tell me they're going to dispute resolution for £70, you know. When is it best? Unless, really. When is it best to just let go?
There's a few points, I think, around that. I think one of the biggest problems for us with cleaning is twofold. The first is the landlord not appreciating that the tenant is only responsible for the areas that he hasn't left clean as they were at the beginning. And very often the situations that we see will be where the landlord is claiming for a full end of tenancy clean because certain parts weren't left clean. So again, it's about managing the landlord's own expectations at that point, that he can only charge the tenants for the highlighted parts. And the second point for me is, on a wider scale, invoices and estimates that we see aren't good for negotiating with the tenant. Now, we talked about ending a tenancy well. If a landlord or an agent wants to end that tenancy well with the tenant, having a detailed invoice or a detailed estimate is really good to negotiate with, because a tenant can clearly see how much those bits that he's responsible for will cost the landlord to put together. Whereas commonly we will see an invoice that says end of tenancy clean, and it can go from anything to £70 to £470. But we don't know what they're doing for that money.
Yes, and I often find that tenants are a bit shocked as to how much it costs to repaint a bedroom, for example. They think that, you know, they can do it with their mate for £50. But, you know, my professional painter and decorator is going to charge me £400 for a room, you know, potentially. And so, you know, that can often lead to misunderstandings, I think.
It can be. Again, there's two sides to that story. A landlord will often claim for repainting a whole room, where maybe a tenant's used blue tack on one wall, and actually the tenant is only then responsible, I know it sounds silly, but only for one wall. So that's the landlord's choice then to redecorate the whole room or just that wall, but only the tenant has to pay for the one wall.
Yes, and it can be a bit tricky to price that up. But I guess, you know, if there are four walls in a room and a ceiling, then you just divide that £400 appropriately. And then you would also need to think how long it was since the property was last redecorated.
Exactly.
And very often you end up claiming £40, I think, from the tenant. And then I think, is it worth it?
Well, I think you're showing yourself up in a very good light, Richard, and you're a very reasonable landlord, which we know. But unfortunately, and I think it's going to get tighter as well with the tenant fee ban, landlords are going to be quite picky about what they can claim for, because they'll recoup costs wherever they can. So tenants really need to be sharp and on the ball as to how to return that property.
Oh, Al, do you think it's going to get tougher for tenants, given the tenant fees ban? Do you think landlords are going to be trying to recoup more from deposits?
I think so. And I think more landlords are viewing property as their form of retirement and retirement income, and therefore they're going into it purely thinking about it from a business perspective, whereas, as I'm sure you know from your experience, being a landlord is as much about interacting with people and those kind of skills. Whereas when you have a landlord who just thinks, how much money can I get from the deposit? Maybe they've only ever seen a property once before they purchase it and give it to a managing agent. They're at a distance removed and there isn't the same human aspect, and then it is viewed as, regardless of the facts, how much of this deposit can I claim, whether I'm allowed to or not. And I think the more professional in some way the landlord is, as in just viewing it as a business, the more likely that is to happen, and that is a trend that I think is going on at the moment.
Just thinking about sort of terrible endings where things have gone really badly, how, you know, I'm imagining something like subletting. It can be quite difficult, can't it, for a landlord to manage that well with the tenant and then to end it well. What is it possible for things like that to end well? What have you seen in your experience?
It is possible, and I actually think the tenant fees ban may make this better, because a lot of the time that subletting occurs, it isn't the kind of nightmare situation that you hear of where someone rents a property and then rents out every room. A lot more common is one tenant wants to leave. The agency says, well, we don't want to have to, you have to pay for a new tenancy agreement, you have to pay for a new deposit protection certificate. In total, it's going to cost you £500 to do that. And they say, well, we don't want to do that. We don't want to move. We're just going to move someone else in, because then we don't pay anything. And that's where the difficulties can begin. And I think the tenant fees ban will reduce the cost of these things and will make more people likely to do it in the correct way. And when they're subletting, it's pretty much a nightmare for everyone involved, even the people who do it, unless they're doing it as kind of as a profession. Most people fall into it. And I don't ever see it end too happily, but what I view as a happy resolution in those circumstances is one where no one's ended up in court, where there is some kind of agreement made, some kind of settlement made, where people take a commercial view of it and say, it's not about who's done this or that wrong, because that's not going to get resolved very easily. It's just a case of what makes financial sense for all of us, so we don't spend money, time and resources when there's actually a resolution where overall each person actually benefits compared to the messy alternative.
Yes, and I'm a huge advocate of landlords really developing those sorts of people skills as well. There are certain situations, aren't there, where tenants can get a refund of their rent or deposits, rent repayment orders, and then if the deposit hasn't been protected, they can actually get a fine against the landlord. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, so at Justice for Tenants, a lot of tenants who contact us because there's a disagreement about deductions. We say, well, why don't you go to a deposit scheme? And they go, oh, what? What's that? We look at their tenancy agreement. We contact all the deposit schemes. The deposit isn't protected. Some deposit schemes refer tenants to us in that situation because they can't provide legal advice. And because of a landlord potentially being unreasonable, a tenant finds out their deposit isn't protected, therefore they can't go through adjudication. Therefore, they're already going to be having to go through the court process. So they often will include a claim for compensation because, separate to the return of the deposit, the Housing Act 2004 says if your deposit isn't correctly protected within 30 days of it being paid, you're entitled to between 1 and 3 times the deposit as compensation. And a lot of times tenants find out about that, not because they already knew, but because they can't resolve a deposit dispute, or they can't find their deposit actually being protected anywhere.
And also, if the property should be licensed and it hasn't been through discretionary licensing, so that'd be selective licensing or additional licensing or mandatory HMO licensing, the tenant can claim 12 months of back rent. Is that right?
That's right. You can do it through the tribunal. I actually just came from representing tenants at tribunal today for just such an application. And I think some landlords are being caught out because they're not always aware when licensing comes in. The way that tenants find out about their right to bring a rent repayment order application often comes because of a Section 21 notice incorrectly served, or because of a deduction from a deposit, which leads to a dispute, which leads to them getting in contact with Justice for Tenants or the Citizens Advice Bureau or a local housing law centre, who will look into it and, as part of their process, discover the property is not licensed. And often at that point, a tenant has been upset to a level that they feel like they're having money, their money taken away, and then they're told, well, you have this right to recover up to 12 months rent, and it's an opportunity for them in their mind to turn the tables and maybe get compensation for what they perceive as either injustices during the tenancy, but often mistreatment at the end of the tenancy with regards to the deposit.
So a very happy ending potentially for tenants there if they manage to get that rent reclaimed, but a bad ending for landlords. And that's where the landlord's been non-compliant, of course, and has managed the tenant poorly by the sounds of it too. OK, well, we're coming to the end of the programme, and I wanted to ask you finally for your top tips on how to end a tenancy well. Lisa, why don't you start us off?
Well, how to end a tenancy well is to start it well, as I mentioned right at the beginning. So make sure you have a good, concise inventory in place, well formatted, great photographs, clear photographs. And also for landlords and agents, very important to get the tenant's signature on that inventory. And if they can't get a signature, then at least an acknowledgement by way of an email that they've received it and that they agree with it. And I'm sure Susie will bear me out that quite a few disputes end up with the ADR services where the tenant says that they didn't sign the inventory because they didn't agree with it. And then it can make it very difficult for a landlord to have a successful resolution. So get the inventory in place and signed. Have good inventory management processes. Carry out regular property inspections. We refer to them as property visits. And ideally, in our opinion, obviously have a independent process so that if there is a dispute at the end, then the landlord or the agent cannot be accused by the tenant of being biased.
Okay, and Susie, your advice, top tips for ending tenancies well.
I think it's really important to maintain relationships from the beginning to the end, because that's going to aid you with ending the tenancy well. So keep good relationships with your agent or your landlord, whoever's managing the property. Make sure you're receptive to all the visits, that you tidy up before those visits happen, and you keep everyone happy along the way. And then follow the end of tenancy guidance. You know, make sure you've checked that inventory from the beginning. Make sure you're well aware of what your responsibilities are from your tenancy agreement. And as far as the inventory goes in terms of condition and cleanliness, and then be receptive to negotiating anything that you haven't left in the same condition.
And Al, have the last word on this, your tips for ending a tenancy well.
For tenants, I'd say take timestamp photos when you leave. For landlords, have the inventory done as soon as the tenants move out, not after some workmen have been in or there've been other people viewing it. And for both parties, if you ever agree anything in writing, maybe a tenant says, oh, that chair's broken, do you mind if I replace it? And the landlord says, fine. Put that in writing, because then it prevents miscommunications at the end. The major cause that I see is people recounting what was said. But as we always say when we're doing something in tribunal or court, if there's no record on it, of it, it's not the truth. It didn't happen. That's the way you have to view it.
It's true. This is the beauty of email, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, a jolly email just confirming a conversation can save a lot of problems later on. Well, that's it for this programme. You can find all 21 editions of the programme and get in touch with us via our website, which is insideproperty.org.uk. But my thanks to my guests, Susie Hirschman, Lisa Williamson and Al McLenahan. And also thanks to you for listening.